Must be a case that you're all interested in. Counsel, we've been having trouble with the microphone in here, and I know the marshal talked to you about it. So if you have any difficulties, let us know, and we'll try to give you a little more time here or there if we have to fool around with the sound system. She thinks she got it fixed. She worked over the lunch hour, so if she did, she did, and if she didn't, we'll do with whatever you have there before you. Are you both ready to proceed? Okay, so I call our last case for the day, Town of Wilson versus City of Sheboygan. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Michael Hoytink. I'm with the Sorrentino Burkert Risch firm in Brookfield, Wisconsin. And I'm here today representing the Town of Wilson, its board, its citizens, in this annexation case. 55 years ago, this court interpreted the term contiguous in the annexation statute and held that exactly what happened in this case did not meet, and I quote from Mount Pleasant, the statutory requirement of contiguity. This court said 55 years ago that what happened in this case was inconsistent with the legislative intent and that term in the statute. For 55 years, the legislature has let that statutory interpretation stand. It's acquiesced in it. And as recently as 2017, this court has said, when this court does a statutory interpretation and the legislature acquiesces in it, it tells us that the legislature said you're right. This is where stare decisis kicks in, and it's as old as the Federalist number 78 in this country.
Even if we leave and honor the precedent of Mount Pleasant, why is this case analogous to Mount Pleasant?
Analogous to Mount Pleasant?
Right.
Sure.
Why should, I mean, you're saying leave statutory precedent, or leave precedent, which I think is a general principle we like to do, but how come this is like Mount Pleasant?
The case is spot on. Here's what Mount Pleasant said. It said when a private party reaches to remote non-contiguous land by building what we'll call a gerrymander or a string to connect it for the purpose of connection, that is not contiguous. That is the Mount Pleasant rule.
Well, how would you have us define contiguous? Because wouldn't you agree that the land touching here is greater than that which was in Mount Pleasant?
It's greater at the point of connection. Yes, it is.
Okay. So how should we define contiguous?
Over the years, you've defined it very different ways, and the court's never given it one definition. I'm going to answer the question directly. It's been given several definitions depending on the context, which is a common statutory intent, statutory interpretation canon. We look at the context of the statute, right? The terms, the context, and everything around it. This court has always taken a practical approach to contiguity. Justice Dallet, you just mentioned touching, but there's precedent from this court that says even if there's a breakage between the territory to be annexed and not, it can still be contiguous. Sometimes touching isn't enough. What it has to do under Mount Pleasant is satisfy the definition of oneness, togetherness. They list those factors in Mount Pleasant. And I will tell you, and be the first one to tell you, I don't know that we can stand here in this case and give every example of what contiguous is in every case. I do know what they said it was in Mount Pleasant, and I do know this is not distinguishable in any material way, and I'll tell you why.
Are you suggesting perhaps that contiguity is something that we know when we see it, but we can't define it?
No, it's capable of definition. What I'm saying is I don't know if I can define it in I don't know, for example, if we sat up here and discussed a different case before Mount Pleasant, that we would ever envision what happened in Mount Pleasant or what happened here would happen.
If that's the case, how are we supposed to, as a matter of judicial administration, in understanding that part of our responsibility is identifying principles of law that can be intelligently understood and applied, how are we supposed to have a definition that changes depending on context.
I'm not saying it changes. I'm saying it might, whatever the context is, may or may not need it. Here is where we start with Mount Pleasant. What I just cited and what's quoted in Mount Pleasant, what the legislature has blessed for 55 years, togetherness, oneness, homogeneity. It's not something that reaches out and creates what
right,
the legislature called crazy.
Yeah, those words
before
you just used.
I'm sorry, before you keep going, can you just raise the mic up a little bit so you talk right into it?
Sure. Is that
okay,
better?
Okay, excellent.
Very
thank
nice.
You. Sorry, go ahead.
Well done.
You told me to be careful with moving it too much. Okay.
So those words you just used,
yes.
Oneness, togetherness, I have no idea what that means.
That apparently the court did in 1964.
Yeah,
it can mean, you start with the dictionary term, and the court even said in one case it can mean touching or it can't, right, because we've defined it both ways. But what I know Mount Pleasant says, what it doesn't mean is when you're reaching for something that's clearly outside the definition like we did here.
And why is that clearly outside the definition?
Sure. What the court said in Mount Pleasant is it leads to, and this is a common statutory construction, absurd results, where you could literally have a 2-foot strip of land that leads down to a targeted parcel.
Right. So why is that an absurd result?
I'm sorry?
Why is that an absurd result?
Sure. Because when the court looked at this situation in Mount Pleasant, it said legislatively the intent was to keep annexations compact, a uniform system of growing. And when you start with that, that's an absurd result.
Okay, yeah, hang on just a second, because what I'm going to try to reach here is some statutory language, right? So, did we go to any statutory authority to say that we're looking for compactness and stuff like that?
Yes, they actually cited in the case the legislative history.
I'm not interested in legislative history, legislative text. Is there any text we can point to that says this is about compactness?
When you look at the annexation statute as a whole, and you have the word contiguous in part of it, but you look down in particular at what the Department of Administration is supposed to look at, the homogeneity, the sameness with the city, that gets you there.
All right, so now we're getting somewhere. So point me to some statutory language that gets you to this idea of oneness and compactness and togetherness.
First of all, I would start with Mount Pleasant because that's what...
Yeah,
but the statutory language...
Don't start with Mount Pleasant. Just get me to the statutes.
So I would point the court to the definition of public interest, which is under subsection 6 in the Department Review of Annexations. I would point the court toward Black's Law Dictionary and Merriam-Webster's Law Dictionary.
Yes. Can you get to statutes?
I'm sorry?
Statutes?
No, that would be it for the statutes. That's all I have.
Those are... Black's Law Dictionary is not a statute. Do you have any statutory language that says that this is about oneness, togetherness, and compactness?
I do not. I just have the language that the court gave me in Mount Pleasant.
Thank you.
Counsel, I wanted to talk a little bit about the rule of reason and as it plays into this. And I understand your argument that Mount Pleasant was really about the statute and acknowledge that it uses that language, but it also doesn't at the same time. There's some internal tension in the opinion. It basically says, you know, we're going to incorporate this idea of the rule of reason. They don't really tell us why or where it comes from. We just kind of say we think we ought to get a second crack at sort of judging whether this makes sense at some level. Therefore, the statute isn't contiguous because we don't think it meets that. I want to talk about just the origins of the rule of reason. There's been some scholarly literature that talks about it and says, well, we don't really know. Is this constitutional? Is this just sort of judge-made public policy making to second-guess it? I'd like your take on it.
And just so I understand the question, would you like me to explain where the rule of reason came from or whether Mount Pleasant...
Well, I read Mount Pleasant to be more about the rule of reason than about contiguity. I understand your argument is not that. So just go ahead and stick to the rule of reason generally, please.
Every time you look at the rule of reason, and it surfaced in one case in 1964, just a few months before Mount Pleasant, they always cite back to a case in 1880.
The Sherry case.
And I will tell you, I have been unable, because it's 1880, to find a lot of history behind that. I would classify the rule of reason as judicial policy making.
Yeah.
That's how I understand where it came. To the second issue you raised, if you fast forward ahead to Mount Pleasant 2, we call it, 1965, and then you go ahead a little bit further to 1973 or 74 and the town of Lyons case, In those two cases, and I understand Mount Pleasant uses the term rule of reason, but it says statutory requirement. In those two cases and some others, the Smith and Becker case we cited in our briefing, this Supreme Court was actually very careful to separate those two analyses. If you look in the town of Lyons, it does a separate contiguity analysis on a parcel that calls B2 without any reference to the rule of reason. Okay? It's a different contiguity issue, like I was discussing with Justice Dowling, right? But they're talking about contiguity statute. They then say we're going to apply the rule of reason and look at this other parcel because contiguity wasn't an issue under this first prong of the current iteration of the rule of reason, whether it's shaped, was an abuse of discretion, arbitrary, capricious. This court, over the years, has been very, very careful to keep that distinction. I posit to you that the reason that the Court of Appeals has asked for clarification on this is that over the years, the Court of Appeals has confused those two things, the statutory requirement of contiguity with the rule of reason, the judicial policymaking, that the shape of the annexation, if it's otherwise contiguous, can't be arbitrary and capricious. And therefore, if the city wasn't involved in drawing that shape, it can't be responsible for it. We called that the private party exception in our briefing. And I think that confusion is a bit ironic because the very case that crafted the private party exception was the Town of Lyons case, the case that kept the two analyses separate. Now when you blend the two, what you have is a Court of Appeals saying we can't square Mount Pleasant with these other cases. And they cite the Mount Pleasant too, and they cite the Town Alliance, and they say it's confusing to us because in the one sense you're telling us a private party's abuse of discretion can't be imputed to the city in terms of a shape of an annexation, yet Mount Pleasant was a private party annexation, and the very rule in Mount Pleasant applies to private parties. The handstands that have been done here, and the reason we ask for clarification directly from you, are unnecessary. They are two separate tests, and they have to be. This court can't say, well, this may or may not be contiguous, but it wasn't an abuse of discretion for you to describe it as such, therefore we're going to excuse the statutory requirement. That is a separate test. The judicial rule of reason has three parts. Number one, was the shape of the annexation, the way it was done, the throwing out of certain people to assure its passage, is that arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion? And that will not be implied to cities such as Sheboygan if there's private parties that designed it, unless the city's a controlling influence. Number two, one we did discuss in our briefs, the city has to show, or the petitioner, private, has to show some need, not want or convenience. And then number three, this kind of catch-all. You know, is there anything else about the annexation that would show it to be arbitrary and capricious? That is all different than this statutory requirement of contiguity.
Counsel, why, I know your opposing counsel didn't make this argument, but, and I recognize our cases have for the last number of years discussed various iterations, sometimes using the three-part test, sometimes not, the case law is not exactly very coherent in terms of providing a clear theme on this. So I want to ask, what is our authority to sort of come up with some factors and sort of second-guess the legislative policy judgments that the legislature has put into statute? I recognize we have done that, but I'm asking you, why should we continue to do that?
In 1970, in the city of Beloit case, this court actually called that out, and it was discussing the needs prong of the rule of reason. And I don't know if it directly answered your question, but let me start there. And the court said, this is somewhat confusingly again, this court said, this is a statutory issue to which we're going to interpret the statute and apply the rule of reason. And in the city of Beloit, they said, until the legislature tells us to stop doing it. The best answer I have for that, Justice Hagedorn, is that the court has been employing this rule of reason since 1880. And has expressly, since at least 1970, invited the legislature to say, stop, tell us to stop. And that has never happened.
The only caveat to the history I'd add is the Sherry case, you know, does discuss it, but it was based on constitutional provisions rather explicitly, right? And those later cases, not Pleasant, its forebear, found a lack, those others, don't actually talk about Sherry at all and don't really employ any sort of constitutional reasoning, even though they say it sort of comes from that.
Are you referencing Sherry, the 1880 case?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
In
fact, Mount Pleasant does reference it, and so does the town of Lincoln as where it all started, but it never gives any analysis.
Right. Right.
It just blesses it and says, we said long ago that we're doing this. It's almost like Marbury versus Madison. You know, find me judicial review anywhere, but the court's been doing it since 1803. So when you look at this case, it really poses three questions to me, one of which we've been discussing in depth already. Number one is, what is the precise Mount Pleasant rule that we can see over the years the legislature has blessed by not overturning it? Number two, does this case fall within it? And I think those two are very straightforward applications. Number three was the issue I was going to get to later, but we've gotten to already, is if it's so straightforward, why all the confusion? You know, why has the Court of Appeals asked three times now, at least, I believe, for clarification on this issue? And let me just finish that part of the discussion since we started it. Mount Pleasant shouldn't be overruled. Concepts of stare decisis and legislative acquiescence would prohibit that. That would, to me, be the ultimate activism to overturn a statutory interpretation that's been blessed and acquiesced in for 55 years. But what does need to happen is it needs to be clarified, and it needs to stop being applied to situations that it doesn't apply to. It's actually a very, very narrow rule, but it applies in spades here. In fact, we started calling this case Mount Pleasant on steroids when we looked at it. And this is why. If you look at the facts of this case, I got permission. I put this exhibit up here, but there's nothing new there. Those are photos that came right out of our briefs. But when you look at it, Kohler comes in 2013 or 2014 to the town of Wilson, where that red part on the left has its now proposed golf course is located, and it applies for a conditional use permit. That's after it originally thought it was going to develop a glamping site there and changed its mind. It explains to the town of Wilson, this is all in the record, in detail why it can do a course there, with services offered by the town of Wilson, including well water, and it put a study into the record, it's in at trial, saying it's fine. We can operate it, and it admitted that at trial. But what it said at trial, and said it directly, was that over a period of time, and this is a quote, a number of things that were happening that making it appear and seemed to be more and more difficult to get this project approved. And in December 2015 or early 2016, they decide the political climate isn't right in the town, and they build this annexation string to circumvent the town, its residents, and its government.
Who's they?
Kohler. Sorry, I was not precise there. It's an it, not a they. Kohler and its employees decide to do this, and they retain a law firm to do it. And all the facts are in the brief, but I would tell you this is even more egregious in Mount Pleasant, because you've got a non-unanimous annexation here in which one of the parcels that's signed to support this is signed by the litigation attorney from the law firm that they hired. We're in Madison. Okay? There's just no dispute. Justice Walsh Bradley, you had a quote in something I was reading the other day that said the court can
must
come
have been here. Brilliant.
I'm sorry. We discussed this before, but so was your opinion in Star Direct.
Okay.
No, but it said the court can come to different conclusions on things, but you're not allowed to ignore facts, okay? And even the trial court didn't do that. There is just no dispute on this record that this annexation, this string, if you will, was built for the purpose of annexation and annexation only. And here's how we know
that. Why is that a problem?
What's that?
Why is that a problem?
It's a problem because Mount Pleasant tells us it's a problem.
Counsel, can I ask about the DOA?
Can I just follow up?
Please, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
So part of the argument here is Mount Pleasant right? I think part of the argument here is Mount Pleasant right? Did he get it right? And what are the contours of that rightness if it did? So Mount Pleasant said so. So why did Mount Pleasant say so? Why did they say that's a problem, that it was constructed for the specific purpose of annexation?
It said it's a problem because if you adopt a rule that allows this, that anything touching designed for this purpose, and this is what it cited in the opinion, you get the absurd result of having a narrow string, just a few feet wide, extend for miles perhaps, to reach some remote property. And Mount Pleasant said, when we look at the legislative intent of what annexations are supposed to do, That is inconsistent with the legislative intent.
Right.
That's where Mount Pleasant came from.
Yeah. So I have a long history of ignoring legislative intent. I focus on the statutory language, right?
Focus on what?
The statutory language?
Yes.
That's what I'm after. And so when I hear an argument that says that leads to an absurd result, I want to see that it's absurd in terms of the statutory language. And if the statutory language simply says contiguous, well, it's contiguous. That's not absurd, right?
Back this way. That was the argument the dissent made in Mount Pleasant, precisely, mm-hmm. almost precisely.
That is
maybe
true.
Maybe not as articulately. And what the majority said is when we look at it goes beyond the language because contiguous can mean different things. It's not subject to one meaning, right? So we're going to look at the history and the intent. And they called out and they said this type of thing is not consistent with legislative intent. And that's what I started my argument with. That's why even if you, Justice Kelly, sitting on Mount Pleasant would have dissented or ruled that way, we're in a different situation now when this court has called out a legislative intent and the legislature has essentially said yes for 55 years. All that needed to happen in any one of those...
I don't know if they necessarily said yes. They might have just said nothing about
yes.
it.
Well, that's not what my language. It's your language from the Breitzel case in 2017 where this court very specifically said when the legislature is presumed to know how this court defined a statute and its intent. And when the legislature does nothing, the presumption is that it's acquiesced in it
right.
and
so
blessed it.
This sounds like a whole lot of bootstrapping, right? So we start with the language that simply says contiguous, and we say, well, it doesn't mean just that. We're going to delve through the legislative history, and we're going to find out what perhaps individual legislators thought. We're going to figure out maybe what LRB thought about this. And we're gonna find out about a variety of people's thoughts. And then we made a decision based on the thoughts, not on the language of the statute. And then we say, well, you know, the legislature hasn't come back after us, and so therefore they must agree. And there are probably about at least six assumptions built into that rule, none of which have any empirical support. So how... Are we really bound to follow that number of unsupported assumptions?
I would argue yes, because of the passage of time, and because in this court...
And does an error become more acceptable over the passage of time?
This court has said in one circumstance, if it's objectively wrong, and let me be very clear and honest... In a subsequent case, the court cited all those propositions I just said that we're not going to redo this stuff when the legislature has all but blessed it, but we can in some cases when we find it to be objectively wrong. There's something wrong we found in the intent. There's some mistake that was made, or whatever this court defines the objective intent. The answer to your question is, if you look at the case law, the answer is you have to find it to be objectively wrong, and I will tell you there are not many cases where that has happened here.
Counsel, just wanted to touch briefly on the DOA certification piece. I'm curious what the implications, you know, of your argument are. So suppose DOA should be doing more. Does that call into question, you know, all of the prior petitions where they have not done more? And I guess as a corollary, you know, they basically represented here, this is good enough for us.
The answer is no. I don't think a rule here would be retroactively applied to annexations that have already passed. But with regard, and this is what we call the POP cert, or population certification, mm-hmm. all we did, you know, in line with what Justice Kelly did, is we at least start with the statute, and the statute says certify. Mm-hmm. And so when I get into what the implications are, when we analyze that, that's not as important as, are we just looking at what the legislature wrote? Because if you reach a conclusion interpreting that statute that causes something that the legislature doesn't want to happen.
So what exactly should we ask, you know, DOA to do? I mean, they've sort of said, well, we did, and here's how we did it. You know, that's how the DOA, is the executive branch, says we're going to execute this law. consistent with their constitutional order. What is it that you're asking us to tell them to do differently other than do more?
Issue a certification of the count that's put on the petition, what the statute says. And the reason I get there is the circuit court said the mere acceptance of that petition showed that they certified it. The problem is that renders that term certified meaningless in the statute. That petition contains all kinds of things that in theory they would accept when they accept the petition. This one says certify, so certify it. I would go back to say issue a certification is how we interpret the term, just looking at it.
And what's the remedy if DOA is not doing its job? Is it your view that if DOA is not doing its job, that nobody can file a petition until such time as DOA does do its job?
Correct. Because that's what the statute says. You know, that may be a bizarre result, but that's a policy consideration. I'm looking at the statute starting there.
Okay.
I see my time is about up. I want to touch briefly, if I can, on two other arguments we made. One, I'll just address quickly, the inclusion of state land here, and I will admit that's a policy argument. We laid it out in the brief. But when you look at the two different ways to count the signatures, the absurd result, that can result by including just a little land and in the assessed value, just accepting at face value that nobody's assessed a value to state land, so you can just pile it on top of it with no real impact on the equation. But the second one I want to address in my short time is this needs analysis, and that does get right to City of Beloit. And I want to be clear, this is a de novo review under this needs analysis in the judicial rule of reason, okay? The City of Beloit was very clear. Wants, needs, city can do it better is not enough. And we don't think it satisfied that prong either. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Please the court. My name is Stan Riffle. I am with the law firm of Municipal Law and Litigation Group out of Waukesha, Wisconsin. I'm very proud to represent the city of Sheboygan here today before you. The purpose here today is to review a determination, a decision of a trial court, a very reasoned decision, an excellent decision. And in that decision, the court was correct on the facts, the court was correct on the law, and the court was correct on the laws applied to the facts. The circuit court's review in this particular case could not have been more extensive. I'm not familiar with a case that a court had so much information brought to it so many times. It started out with shortly after the lawsuit was filed, there was a motion by the town for injunctive relief to put everything on hold. That issue was completely briefed. All of the issues were addressed the same as if they were at trial. The court issued a 43-page decision finding that there was not a likelihood of success on the merits. Then both parties filed summary judgment motions, cross-summary judgment motions, again, completely briefed, all issues addressed, and the court initially denied both motions. Ultimately, several weeks later, we filed a motion for partial summary judgment on the certification issue we've been talking about. The court got the affidavit from Mr. Schmicke of the Department of Administration, which said we certified it and granted partial summary judgment in that manner. Then the court held a two-day trial, 12 witnesses, 43 exhibits. The court carefully looked at all of those exhibits and issued a 75-page decision, 24 pages of which are findings of fact. I want to take great exception to the town's statement as to what the standard of review here is. They've conflated the standard of review in this case, and they've confused the standard of review. There was one question of law in this case before the trial court. There's another one that's been introduced since that time that I'm going to ask you to ignore because it wasn't raised at the time of trial. But the one issue is the question of whether or not the annexation was contiguous. All of the other issues, every one of them, including all of the issues pertaining to the rule of reason, are questions of law applied to findings of fact. They're very fact intensive. The court went through very thoroughly and as I said, 24 pages of facts that the court appropriately applied the law to. And the court's findings are entitled to deference and cannot be set aside unless clearly erroneous. They are not clearly erroneous.
Let's just stop there for a second, because the rule of reason in the three factors uses the words, I think, arbitrary or arbitrary and capricious. Are those something that the court concludes is arbitrary and capricious? Are you saying that that's a factual determination as opposed to a legal determination?
Justice Bradley, clearly you can't determine if something is arbitrary or capricious unless it is tested against the facts in the record.
Sure, historical facts, that's right.
Exactly.
But isn't the standard of arbitrary and capricious a legal standard? You apply the historical facts to the legal standard and come up with a legal determination.
It is a mixed question of law and fact. My particular position on that on behalf of the city is that that is so fact-intensive that unless it's clearly erroneous, that trial court's determination as to the application of the law to those facts should not be overturned.
Yeah, the application of the law to the facts is generally a de novo review. Historical facts is clearly erroneous. Do you disagree with that? It sounds like you do.
I do. First of all, I don't recall any guidance anywhere relating to the rule of reason as it pertains to the issue of the standard review. I believe that because those issues are so fact-intensive, it really, and remember, there's a presumption of validity to the legislative act in the first instance, that I think clearly the deference to the trial court's determination of facts is imperative, and we don't get to a de novo review in that regard. That's my position. So there are some underlying basic premises I want to remind this court of underlying the body of annexation law. And it has to do with petitioners' rights and the authority granted to cities and villages by the legislature. The rights of landowners to petition for annexation is an extremely valuable property right. It goes along with all the other bundle of property rights that a property owner enjoys. And this court has noted that petitioning to annex is analogous to voting, and the will of the petitioners must be respected. That was the Town of Metairie case. Likewise, with regard to the authority granted to cities and villages, the legislature has conferred broad authority to annex land out of unincorporated territories under Chapter 66. This implicates the separation of powers. It is recognized that there's a presumption of validity of annexation ordinances, just as all other ordinances adopted by a legislative body like a common council. And a party challenging that annexation ordinance has a burden that's been regarded as a heavy burden by this court. And the determination of the trial court in this matter that they did not overcome that heavy burden should be upheld here.
How would you have us define contiguity?
I would define contiguity, first of all, let's look at the history of what we have here. And I think it's important in terms of my answering that question to you, Justice Dellett. So we've all recognized that contiguous has not been defined by the statute at all. It has been defined by this court in the Waukesha versus Salvation case. Obviously, it was an incorporation case, but contiguity was involved in that case because my client, the city of Pewaukee, back in 1986, tried to convince this court that it was contiguous to the city of Milwaukee, even though it's 7 miles away. Contiguous in that case was defined as touching along boundaries, often for considerable distances, or touching at an angle, adjacent, next to or adjoining with nothing similar intervening, nearby, close, not distant. I will want to go through the cases subsequent to Mount Pleasant, but I'll answer your question directly. Based upon how that law has developed since Mount Pleasant, I would say that the definition of contiguous should be touching or nearly touching under exigent circumstances.
Under exigent?
Exigent circumstances.
What does that mean, under exigent circumstances?
Okay. I'll use three examples. Well, first of all, let's recognize that the stretch of contact here on this annexation was 650 feet. In Mount Pleasant, it was 153 feet. since Mount Pleasant, and that was determined to be non-contiguous. Since Mount Pleasant, you have the Sugar Creek versus Elkhorn case, 1999, describing a narrow finger as the contiguity. It does not tell us how many feet were there. I tried to get it off of the DOA website, but they don't go back that far. We have the Baraboo versus Baraboo 2005 Court of Appeals case where they found a 200-foot connection is contiguous. We have the Waukechan versus Shawano 1972 case where they found that 575 feet of continuous connectivity was contiguous. And then when I get to the exigent circumstances of non-touching, I hearken back to Lyons, where the court determined that a 23-foot right-of-way gap does not create a non-contiguity situation. And ever since, we municipal lawyers have recognized that town roads are no man's land. You have Delavan versus Delavan, where there's a 400-foot gap between the annexed lands and the city of Delavan. That was a lake bed. And then you have Town of Campbell versus La Crosse. I was involved in that case. The Town of Campbell is an island in the middle of the Black River, and it is separated by that river, half of that river, from the city of La Crosse. And the court made a determination in that case that it was contiguous. So that is my rationale behind the exigent circumstances. Those are the types of exigent circumstances that would fall into my definition. I do want to ask this court one thing. Based upon Mount Pleasant, if it is good law, are we to conclude that if a annexation is attached by a strip that is 153 feet in width, anything less than that is not contiguous, and anything more than that is contiguous? What is the guidepost? How are we supposed to deal with that? How is a trial court supposed to deal with that?
Well, that's why I asked you. So your definition, though, doesn't really, this exigent circumstances doesn't really define it very well, does it? That could be subject to a court's determination of exigent circumstances.
That's true, but I think that's the law. I think that's where we are at based upon the progeny of Mount Pleasant. Okay. And I also want to draw a distinction. We have all this confusion between the statutory requirement of contiguity and how you treat the shape and the homogeneity of an annexation under the first prong of rule of reason. I would suggest to you that what the legislature intended, notwithstanding Mount Pleasant 1, that the definition of contiguous was for purposes of making sure that there was some type of touching or nearly touching, so that it would make you don't want some land that is, half a mile away to be able to be brought into the city.
Counsel, I thought one of the beauties of your argument was going to be, let's just have a clear rule. Enough of this confusion. And the clear rule would be if they're touching. But it sounds to me like your rule that you've given in response to Justice Dalit isn't much better. That is the individual case of the town of Lincoln or the town of Shawano or the town of Arena, is that going to be exigent circumstances? Who knows until a court decides? That's not much certainty, is it? And you had touching or nearly touching. Oh, my goodness, what does nearly touching mean? Does it mean 153 feet? Does it mean 1.1 mile? Who knows, unless it goes to court. So the beauty, I thought, when I started in preparation of this case, is you were going to come up with something that helps us struggle with the confusion that apparently has emanated even from Mount Pleasant 1 when they bring in this rule of reason and the statutory definition, when they say in reviewing everything, it's towards the end of the opinion. So, why is yours
you want to get rid of Mount Pleasant, but you want to embrace Lyons case and the Delavan case and the town of Campbell cases, exigent circumstances, so you don't want to overrule those. Maybe your opposing counsel wants to overrule those, but keep town of Pleasant. So, what? You know, give me something I can hold on to here.
Well, I'm not going to try to sidestep the question, Justice Bradley, but I will say that it is not necessary to overrule Mount Pleasant 1 in order for my client to prevail, because my client prevails either under the statutory definition of contiguity or as it was interpreted in Mount Pleasant 1. The trial case made that very clear.
My question is, I thought you were going to give me something clear, and you've given me something that's just potentially as confusing.
I did that because I am trying to take a look at the body of law that this court itself has put into place for us today. And if this court finds it necessary or desirable to do away with Mount Pleasant 1, I want to make sure that there is no concern over a fallout with regard to Crazy Quilt or gerrymandered annexations, because those can be handled under the first prong of the rule of reason.
Counsel, if I may, just for clarification then, you don't want this court to overturn Mount Pleasant 1. Is that correct?
I don't believe the court has to overturn Mount Pleasant. I am not advocating one way or the other whether you overturn Mount Pleasant. I'm simply pointing out that Mount Pleasant is antithetical to our annexation for the reasons that I have alluded to in terms of the extent, the substantial connection between this this land and the city. And I would also point out,
what about that?
Substantial
connection. That sounds a lot better than exigent circumstances.
Well, substantial connection is a term that was used in Lincoln. It certainly, then you get to the point of whether or not, if it's interrupted by a short body of water where you can get sewer and water to folks that want it underneath the water, does that break up the contiguity? These are difficult questions, which is why I came up with the suggestion that I did, because I was trying to amalgamize everything that we've been dealing with over the 40 years for me, and I've dealt with these issues for 38 of those 40 years.
So instead of developing a theory of everything, perhaps we could just look at this case very narrowly and say that it
is a pun.
I'm sorry.
Is that a pun, Justice?
It is now. We could simply say that for your purposes, certainly touching is enough.
Yes.
All right. And you don't need to go any further than that.
That's true.
Okay.
So I would like to talk about the rule of reason a bit.
Well, let's go a little further. Touching is enough. Here you have the difference between when it touches, I think the difference between 650 feet and which is about your numbers, I might be off a little bit. And
you're correct, Justice
Bradley. 153 feet. You know, touching is enough. Is 2 feet enough?
Well, touching at a corner would be enough under that definition.
Okay. I mean, is that what you're advancing? Any kind of touching.
I'm just agreeing with Justice Kelly.
I know.
You don't have to do that.
Let me tell you.
It's a fine thing to do.
On opposite ends for a reason.
I just want to know.
Yes.
Would 2 feet, 1 feet,
yes,
something really low. So are you really saying any touching?
I was asked whether or not it would upset my case if the definition of contiguity meant touching, and I said, no, it would not.
And now I'm asking you if you are advocating for a test of any touching, no matter how de minimis.
I am taking no position with regard to that issue. Our annexation that we have before us here today passes the test, irrespective of whether contiguous means touching or contiguous means more than 153 feet of connectivity. So
Counsel, I know you're wanting to make sense of our prior cases, and obviously you're being a good advocate, and your client wins under every plausible scenario. But we are in a position of having to reconcile a body of case law that I think that both you and your opposing counsel recognize has quite a bit of tension and quite a bit of a lack of clarity with it. And so while we certainly are interested in resolving your case, we are quite interested in getting a standard of law that's going to ensure clarity and predictability for future cases. So I want to ask you a question. Assume we had no body of case law on this. Read the statute and tell me what you think the rule of law should be applied to this case.
Well, it boils down specifically to the definition of contiguity. I personally think that Mount Pleasant 1 was wrongly decided because the term contiguity, in my mind, does not connote something in excess of 153 feet of length of continuous attachment. If you look at the generally everyday understood definition of contiguous, you would come to the conclusion that it would be touching in some nature. So if we're only looking at that term and we look in the dictionary and we see all the various potential definitions of it, the one, the clear definition is touching.
Great. I want to briefly turn to the rule of reason argument. I asked your counsel whether, your opposing counsel, whether he thought that had some constitutional basis or judicial public policy making of some sort, and he thought that the best read of it, that it was more akin to judicial public policy making. I wonder if you agree with that, if so, what we should do about that. And I'll just be honest here, as I'm reading through the briefs here and I'm trying to ask these questions, studying for this case, what does it mean to have a need? I have no idea what any of that means. It seems that, as Justice Wilkie, I think, pointed out in his dissent in Mount Pleasant, that looks a whole lot more like a legislative judgment than a judicial judgment. What are we to do with that?
Well, I think that the rule of reason emanated as this court being a court of equity. And the legislature, in legislating the rules relating to annexation, can't think through or put enough words in the statute to deal with every circumstance. And so I think that is the genesis for the rule of reason. As it relates to need, Justice Hagedorn, I look at the body case law that's developed relating to the second prong of the rule of reason, such that this is not an organic need. We as human beings need air, we need water, we need food, and in a couple of months in Wisconsin, we're going to need shelter. But I look at it more along the lines, and I think it's borne out in the case law, if it's 55 degrees outside, I need a jacket. That would be handy. Will I die if I don't have a jacket? No. But the court has said that need is a low bar, and a municipality need not have a pressing imperative need to annex territory. A show of reasonable need is sufficient. And it also should be pointed out that the law that has developed looks at both the needs of the petitioner and the needs of the city. And in this case, the court exhaustively referenced for you, in both cases, the needs that the petitioner showed and the needs that the city showed. In the case of the petitioner, it was truly an organic need. As you look through the record, you'll recognize that the political winds had shifted in the town and that a local group called the Friends of the Black River were successful to get three individuals that were avowedly opposed to this golf course on the town board. And the Plan Commission chairman, who was likewise opposed to this, was placed in that position. They made a very clear showing that zoning was the reason, in my view, it was the main reason why they sought this annexation. If they were to remain in the town, this project would be dead, and that's organic. They also showed that the town had approached the city to attempt a border agreement that would have shut off these lands from annexation in return for opening other lands for possible annexation. they did show that they wanted the city water. They wanted the city water for several reasons. One, it's more reliable, continuous source than a deep well, but also the folks in the area with wells were in advance already complaining that this deep well was going to dry up their wells. And Kohler had had a similar situation to their beautiful golf courses to the north of the city of Sheboygan, where exactly the same thing happened after the fact, and property owners made claims. And it was very difficult to deal with these in terms of any of the proofs. And if they were to oppose these, obviously they would be having a bad name in the community. So, and then fire service, there was a situation in the town at the time where that fire company was in complete disarray and they felt that the city of Sheboygan would provide better service. And on the city's part, all of these lands that are depicted on that exhibit I've seen 140 times, have been in the city's comprehensive plan from their very first comprehensive plan in 2003. And all of the territory there that is proposed for development is proposed for development exactly as envisioned in the comprehensive plan. It was shown that there'd be immediate opportunity for development of single-family housing in that annexation territory. In fact, the city owns a portion of that territory that it purchased for the purpose of putting in single-family housing. And subsequent to that time, the city has annexed the rest of that territory. It's called the Poth Farm. And the city showed that they have a tremendous need for single-family residential housing, and they proposed subdivisions in that territory. So the city also showed that this would generate $1.2 million in tax revenue annually, create 227 jobs, generate new hotel tax revenue. They would be able to extend their sewer and water service into this area. Their sewer and water services, they have lots of capacity in their utilities. And finally, they would be able to realize planned extension of north-south streets for the benefit not only of the city but of the entire area. So in terms of need, there's no question that need was demonstrated. And again, it's not an organic need. It is simply a reasonable need. And these are, each and every one of them, are reasonable needs.
Court decided to get rid of the rule of reason in its analysis. What are the repercussions of that?
Well, I would suspect that perhaps at that point the legislature would come in. I don't want to go into the political infighting between the Towns Association, the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, but there would be a lot of discussion on the hill,
okay,
up here about that.
Let me rephrase that so we don't have to try to envision the future legislative battles. What are the negative consequences or positive consequences of removing the rule of reason from the analytical construct?
I'll give you an example of a case I was just involved in. It involved two municipalities in the in Waukesha County. I represented a town. There was an annexation proposed that would attach a piece of property that was in more than 1 mile distant from the village by the right-of-way of Highway 164, State Trunk Highway 164. I think that would create a terrible situation in that all types of practical problems would crop up. And that would be one example of a negative potential for doing away with the rule of reason.
Your opposing counsel, I guess it's the Towns Association maybe, that talks about, they refer to as practical consequences. What are some of the practical consequences in the example that you just gave?
Well, in that particular instance, there would be no way that village reaching out that far would be able to extend any utility services. The police would be a great distance from that territory. Fire would be a great distance from that territory. There would be practical implications here. It really boils down to, is there any sense to a situation like that? And the rule of reason protects against very, very far out circumstances like that. I mean, what would be the end point if you're 10 miles away, if you're 20 miles away? If we do away with the rule of reason, there's no check on that. because there will be, assuming that you do away with Mount Pleasant 1 and the contiguity issue, I mean, I guess that would be a fail-safe situation. But, you know, I've thought through this a lot. I've done municipal law for 40 years, and I think it would be a bad thing to do away with the rule of reason.
What's your response to Justice Wilkie and his those who came after him saying, well, that may be, but those are policy judgments, and that's why you elect policymakers, both at the local level and at the state level, to determine policy rather than asking judges to do that?
Sounds like Justice Kelly's incarnate from Justice Wilkie. That is in your laps, not in mine. I mean, you have to make that determination. I think I've answered the question relating to the practical effects, but perhaps that would be something then that the legislature would take up. If I could, I don't have a great deal of time here. This certification situation. The only evidence before the trial court was that there was a subsequent population estimate certified as acceptable. In Mr. Schmidtke's affidavit, he is the individual right here who works for the department, and he's a gatekeeper and the individual that marshals through these annexation petitions in terms of making the public interest determination. And he stated that commencement of the DOA review certifies that the population estimate is acceptable to the department. End of story. The court had that piece of evidence alone to make its determination and make its factual finding, and so it found to that extent.
The statutes covering annexation have to be strictly complied with, is that
yes.
Correct? All right. Is it strict compliance to provide the certification after the petition instead of in conjunction with it?
It is done in conjunction as a statutory scheme is set up during the department's review. Any time before the end of their review, they have to certify, which is a term that is not defined in the statute. To me, what it connotes is legislature delegated this authority and this responsibility to the department without any guidance at all, and it's up to the department to make a determination how it does it. The department swore in an affidavit that it did it. This is how we do it. There should be no further question about it. It's done. That finally, with regard to this issue relating to somehow there has to be an analysis of land that has no value. I'm sorry, I'm done.
You can just give yourself a sentence and then try to pull together your argument, counsel.
You know, the statute allows for a majority of either the owners of the land by acreage or by assessed value. Assessed value is defined in the statute as what's on the tax roll. If you go to the tax roll in the town, the year of the annexation, and you look in the tax roll, there will be an amount assigned, a value assigned to the state land, zero, an amount assigned to the city land, zero. It's a facetious argument, in my opinion. Thank you.
Rebuttal, counsel?
Let's start quickly with the standard of review, because that shouldn't be in dispute. Smith-Becker case, 2003, WISAP, hit it, and this is what it said. Whether the circuit court's findings of fact meet the legal standards of the rule of reason presents a question of law which we review de novo. The same thing when you're interpreting what a statute means, this is a de novo review. The only time it goes clearly erroneous is, for example, if the court says, I find Kohler could not run that golf course without municipal water. If we were challenging that factual finding, that would be a clearly erroneous standard. Whether a factual finding that says they could do it, but it's better with the city, meets the need test set by this court is a de novo review. As Justice Bradley said, the application of law to facts has always been a de novo review.
Quick question on that. I understand that's what we've said, and that makes some sense. On the other hand, to the extent the rule of reason actually derives from equitable principles, normally our equity review is not de novo.
I'm I'm sorry.
Normally, when we review equitable decisions, it's not de novo. Normally, it's for...
This comes from any equity. It's policymaking. Equity to me is separate from that. Is it fair to somebody or not fair to somebody? That's not what the court's looking at here.
Okay.
I'm going to posit to this court, too, and I'll just put this right out there. You cannot uphold this annexation unless you overturn Mount Pleasant. To do so would be to say this. The difference between 153 feet and 675 feet is the determinative factor in that Mount Pleasant decision, and you will find nothing like it in the decision. It cites to the absurd result as an extreme, as we usually do when we're saying if we interpret a statute some way, it may get that far. And it uses the example of a few feet. We can go through, and we did, in the table in our briefs. This one is longer, more winding. What he's positing, this dimension versus dimension dispute, is going to lead you to something unworkable. Is it 150 feet or 600 feet?
Do you have any problem with the certification that was provided with respect to population?
Yes, there was no certification.
Is that because of the contents of it or when it was provided?
It's because nothing happened other than the DOA said, we believe we met the certification requirement of the statute because we deem it acceptable after the fact. First of all, it's after the fact. Second of all, contrary to what Mr. Ripple said, you don't owe the DOA any deference in interpreting a statute. That statute says certify, and that means something beyond what happened here.
So what does it mean to you? What does it mean to you in this context?
What was
DOA required to do to provide a certification?
Certification has to be a communication back to say your population estimate, the way or your count, is satisfactory to us, even though you didn't use census data.
Isn't that what the affidavit said?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that what the affidavit said?
No, after the fact. It never came
in before. Okay, so it's timing for you.
And it didn't say that. It's partially timing, but he never communicated that back. What they said is we got it in.
To whom? Back to whom?
Back to the petitioner. Never did that. That didn't happen here. What Mr. Schmidtke said is, I got it in. We deemed it. It's certified.
Is there, and pardon me for not knowing this, is there a requirement in the statute that that be communicated back to the petitioner?
We think that is inherent in the term certified because that's the only requirement that has that certified on it, of which I'm aware as I'm standing here. It's got to mean something. We gave you the dictionary definitions to go with the term. It's got to mean something. They didn't even posit anything else. They just said we deemed it certified. It's got to mean something more than that.
If this is the way DOA has done certifications year after year after year after year, you still would find that insufficient?
Correct. It doesn't meet the definition of the statute.
We have a lot of annexations that should get pitched then, right?
I don't think this decision would be retroactive, as I said before. And secondly, that's a policy decision for the legislature to make. None of you, we, decided to put the term certify into that particular requirement.
But the DOA is designated by the legislature to perform this service, correct?
Yes.
And the DOA is the one that performed it, correct?
And it has discretion in areas of its expertise, not in whether it met a statutory requirement.
They interpret the statute, though, as part of their obligation to the legislation, correct?
They do, and you don't owe that any deference. No court does.
I was just going to ask, since our decision in Tetra Tech, do we owe their interpretation of the statute any deference?
Nope. I want to just close with this on the Mount Pleasant thing, because this is where Justice Kelly, we were probably at odds, but this is a quote from this Supreme Court, from the Ryder case in 1980. The legislature is presumed to know that in the absence of its changing the law, the construction put upon it by the courts will remain unchanged. Thus, when the legislature acquiesces or refuses to change the law, it has acknowledged the court's interpretation of legislative intent is correct.
Thank you. Thank you both. It's a very interesting argument. We get questions about annexations from time to time, and they're always very interesting. So thank you for fine briefs and very nice arguments. We will adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:05.